The Last Kingdom by Bernard Cornwell. Read by Tom Selwood.
Prologue. Northumbria, 866 to 867 AD. My name is Ortrud. I am the son of Ortrud. Who was the son of Ortrud? And his father was also called Ortrud. My father's clerk, a priest called Beorca, spelt it Ortrud. I do not know if that was how my father would have written it, for he could neither read nor write, but I can do both. And sometimes I take the old parchments from their wooden chest, and I see the name spelt Ortrud, or Ortrud, or Ogtrud, or Utrud. I look at those parchments, which are deeds saying that Ortrud, son of Ortrud, is the lawful and sole owner of the lands that are carefully marked by stones and by dikes, by oaks and by ash, by marsh and by sea, and I dream of those lands, wave-beaten and wild beneath the wind-driven sky. I dream and know that one day I will take back the land from those who stole it from me. I am an elderman, though I call myself Earl Ortrud, which is the same thing, and the fading parchments are proof of what I own. The law says I own that land, and the law, we are told, is what makes us men under God instead of beasts in the ditch. But the law does not help me take back my land. The law wants compromise. The law thinks money will compensate for loss. The law, above all, fears the blood feud. But I am Ortrud, son of Ortrud, and this is the tale of a blood feud. It is a tale of how I will take from my enemy what the law says is mine. And it is the tale of a woman and of her father, a king. He was my king, and all that I have I owe to him. The food that I eat, the hall where I live, and the swords of my men all came from Alfred, my king, who hated me. This story begins long before I met Alfred. It begins when I was 10 years old and first saw the Danes. It was the year 866, and I was not called Ortrud then, but Osbert, for I was my father's second son, and it was the eldest who took the name Ortrud. My brother was 17 then, tall and well-built, with our family's fair hair and my father's morose face. The day I first saw the Danes, we were riding along the seashore with hawks on our wrists. There was my father, my father's brother, my brother, myself, and a dozen retainers. It was autumn. The sea cliffs were thick with the last growth of summer. There were seals on the rocks, and a host of seabirds wheeling and shrieking, too many to let the hawks off their leashes. We rowed till we came to the crisscrossing shallows that rippled between our land and Lindisfarina, the holy island. And I remember staring across the water at the broken walls of the abbey. The Danes had plundered it, but that had been many years before I was born. And though the monks were living there again, the monastery had never regained its former glory. I also remember that day as beautiful. And perhaps it was. Perhaps it rained, but I do not think so. The sun shone, the seas were low, the breakers gentle and the world happy. The hawk's claws gripped my wrist through the leather sleeve, her hooded head twitching because she could hear the cries of the white birds. We had left the fortress in the forenoon, riding north, and though we carried hawks, we did not ride to hunt, but rather so my father could make up his mind. We ruled this land. My father, Elderman Ortrud, was lord of everything south of the Tweed and north of the Tyne. But we did have a king in Northumbria, and his name, like mine, was Osbert. He lived to the south of us, rarely came north and did not bother us. But now a man called Aela wanted the throne, and Aela, who was an elderman from the hills west of Eoferic, had raised an army to challenge Osbert, and had sent gifts to my father to encourage his support. My father, I realize now, held the fate of the rebellion in his grip. I wanted him to support Osbert, for no other reason than the rightful king shared my name. And foolishly, at 10 years old, I believed any man called Osbert must be noble, good, and brave. In truth, Husband was a dribbling fool. But he was the king, and my father was reluctant to abandon him. But Osbert had sent no gifts, and had shown no respect, while Ayla had, and so my father worried. At a moment's notice, we could lead 150 men to war, all well-armed, and given a month, we could swell that force to over 400 foemen. So whichever man we supported would be the king, and grateful to us. Or so we thought. And then I saw them. Three ships. In my memory, they slid from a bank of sea mist. And perhaps they did. But memory is a faulty thing. And my other images of that day are of a clear, cloudless sky. So perhaps there was no mist. But it seems to me that one moment the sea was empty, and the next there were three ships coming from the south. Beautiful things. They appeared to rest weightless on the ocean, and when their oars dug into the waves, they skimmed the water. Their prows and sterns curled high and were tipped with gilded beasts, serpents and dragons, and it seemed to me that on that far-off summer's day, the three boats danced on the water, propelled by the rise and fall of the silver wings of their oar banks. The sun flashed off the wet blades, splinters of light. Then the oars dipped and were tugged, and the beast-headed boats surged, and I stared entranced. "The devil's turds," my father growled. He was not a very good Christian, but he was frightened enough at that moment to make the sign of the cross. "And may the devil swallow them," my uncle said. His name was Aelfric, and he was a slender man, sly, dark, and secretive. The three boats had been rowing northward, their square sails furled on their long yards. But when we turned back south to canter homeward on the sand, so that our horses' manes tossed like wind-blown spray and the hooded hawks mewed in alarm, the ships turned with us. Where the cliff had collapsed to leave a ramp of broken turf, we rode inland, the horses heaving up the slope, and from there we galloped along the coastal path to our fortress, to Bebbanburg. Bebba had been a queen in our land many years before, and she'd given her name to my home, which is the dearest place in all the world. The fort stands on a high rock that curls out to sea. The waves beat on its eastern shore and break white on the rock's northern point, and a shallow sea lake ripples along the western side between the fortress and the land. To reach Bebbanburg, you must take the causeway to the south, a low strip of rock and sand that is guarded by a great wooden tower, the Low Gate, which is built on top of an earthen wall. We thundered through the tower's arch, our horses white with sweat, and rode past the granaries, the smithy, the mews and the stables, all wooden buildings well thatched with rye straw, and so up the inner path to the high gate, which protected the peak of the rock that was surrounded by a wooden rampart encircling my father's hall. There we dismounted, letting slaves take our horses and hawks, and ran to the eastern rampart from where we gazed out to sea. The three ships were now close to the islands where the puffins live and the seal folk dance in winter. We watched them, and my stepmother, alarmed by the sound of hooves, came from the hall to join us on the rampart.
"The devil has opened his bowels," my father greeted her.
"God and his saints preserve us," Guther said, crossing herself. I had never known my real mother, who had been my father's second wife, and like his first had died in childbirth. So both my brother and I, who were really half-brothers, had no mother. But I thought of Guther as my mother, and on the whole she was kind to me, kinder indeed than my father, who did not much like children. Guther wanted me to be a priest, saying that my elder brother would inherit the land and become a warrior to protect it, so I must find another life path. She had given my father two sons and a daughter, but none had lived beyond a year. The three ships were coming closer now. It seemed they had come to inspect Bebbanburg, which did not worry us, for the fortress was reckoned impregnable, and so the Danes could stare all they wanted. The nearest ship had twin banks of 12 oars each, and as the ship coasted 100 paces offshore, a man leaped from the ship's side and ran down the nearer bank of oars, stepping from one shaft to the next like a dancer, and he did it wearing a mail shirt and holding a sword. We all prayed he would fall, but of course he did not. He had long fair hair, very long, and when he had pranced the full length of the ore bank, he turned and ran the shafts again. "She was trading at the mouth of the Tyne a week ago," Aelfric, my father's brother, said.
"You know that?"
"I saw her," Aelfric said. "I recognise that prow. See how there's a light-coloured strake on the bend," he spat. "She didn't have a dragon's head then."
"They take the beast heads off when they trade," my father said. "What were they buying?"
"Exchanging pelts for salt and dried fish. Said they were merchants from Hytherbu."
"The merchants looking for a fight now," my father said. "And the Danes on the three ships were indeed challenging us by clashing their spears and swords against their painted shields. But there was little they could do against Bebbanburg, and nothing we could do to hurt them, though my father ordered his wolf banner raised. The flag showed a snarling wolf's head, and it was his standard in battle. But there was no wind, and so the banner hung limp, and its defiance was lost on the pagans, who, after a while, became bored with taunting us, settled to their thwarts and rode off to the south. "We must pray," my stepmother said. Guther was much younger than my father. She was a small, plump woman with a mass of fair hair and a great reverence for St. Cuthbert, whom she worshipped because he had worked miracles. In the church beside the hall, she kept an ivory comb that was said to have been Cuthbert's beard comb, and perhaps it was. "We must act," my father snarled.
He turned away from the battlements.
"You," he said to my elder brother Uhtred, "take a dozen men, ride south. Watch the pagans, but nothing more, you understand? If they land their ships on my ground, I want to know where."
"Yes, father."
"But don't fight them," my father ordered. "Just watch the bastards, and be back here by nightfall."
6 other men were sent to rouse the country. Every free man owed military duty, and so my father was assembling his army, and by the morrow's dusk he expected to have close to 200 men, some armed with axes, spears, or reaping hooks, while his retainers, those men who lived with us in Bebbanburg, would be equipped with well-made swords and hefty shields.
"If the Danes are outnumbered,"
my father told me that night, "they won't fight."
"They're like dogs, the Danes, cowards at heart, but they're given courage by being in a pack."
It was dark, and my brother had not returned, but no one was unduly anxious about that. Uhtred was capable, if sometimes reckless, and doubtless he would arrive in the small hours, and so my father had ordered a beacon lit in the iron becket on top of the high gate to guide him home. We reckoned we were safe in Bebbanburg, for it had never fallen to an enemy's assault. Yet my father and uncle were still worried that the Danes had returned to Northumbria.
"They're looking for food," my father said. "The hungry bastards want to land, steal some cattle, then sail away."
I remembered my uncle's words, how the ships had been at the mouth of the Tyne trading furs for dried fish. So how could they be hungry? But I said nothing. I was 10 years old, and what did I know of Danes? I did know that they were savages, pagans and terrible. I knew that for 2 generations before I was born, their ships had raided our coasts. I knew that Father Beocca, my father's clerk, and our mass priest prayed every Sunday to spare us from the fury of the Northmen, but that fury had passed me by. No Danes had come to our land since I'd been born. But my father had fought them often enough, and that night as we waited for my brother to return, he spoke of his old enemy. "They came," he said, "from northern lands, where ice and mist prevailed. They worshipped the old gods, the same ones we had worshipped before the light of Christ came to bless us, and when they had first come to Northumbria," he told me, "fiery dragons had whipped across the northern sky. Great bolts of lightning had scarred the hills, and the sea had been churned by whirlwinds." "They are sent by God," Guther said timidly, "to punish us."
"Punish us for what?"
my father demanded savagely. For our sins, Guther said, making the sign of the cross.
Our sins be damned, my father snarled. They come here because they're hungry.
He was irritated by my stepmother's piety, and he refused to give up his wolf-head's banner that proclaimed our family's descent from Woden, the ancient Saxon god of battles. The wolf, Eldwulf the smith had told me, was one of Woden's three favoured beasts, the others being the eagle and the raven. My mother wanted our banner to show the cross, but my father was proud of his ancestors, though he rarely talked about Woden. Even at 10 years old, I understood that a good Christian should not boast of being spawned by a pagan god. But I also liked the idea of being a god's descendant, and Eldwulf often told me tales of Woden, how he had rewarded our people by giving us the land we called England, and how he had once thrown a war spear clear around the moon, and how his shield could darken the midsummer sky, and how he could reap all the corn in the world with one stroke of his great sword. I liked those tales. They were better than my stepmother's stories of Cuthbert's miracles. Christians, it seemed to me, were forever weeping, and I did not think Woden's worshippers cried much. We waited in the hall. It was, indeed it still is, a great wooden hall, strongly thatched and stout-beamed, with a harp on a dais, and a stone hearth in the centre of the floor. It took a dozen slaves a day to keep that great fire going, dragging the wood along the causeway and up through the gates. And at summer's end, we would make a log pile bigger than the church, just as a winter store. At the edges of the hall were timber platforms, filled with rammed earth and layered with woolen rugs, and it was on those platforms that we lived, up above the drafts. The hounds stayed on the bracken-strewn floor below, where lesser men could eat at the year's four great feasts. There was no feast that night, just bread and cheese and ale, and my father waited for my brother and wondered aloud if the Danes were restless again. They usually come for food and plunder, he told me, but in some places they've stayed and taken land. You think they want our land? I asked.
They'll take any land, he said irritably.
He was always irritated by my questions, but that night he was worried, and so he talked on.
Their own land is stone and ice, and they have giants threatening them.
I wanted him to tell me more about the giants, but he brooded instead.
Our ancestors, he went on after a while, took this land. They took it and made it and held it. We do not give up what our ancestors gave us. They came across the sea and they fought here, and they built here, and they're buried here. This is our land, mixed with our blood, strengthened with our bone. Ours.
He was angry, but he was often angry. He glowered at me, as if wondering whether I was strong enough to hold this land of Northumbria that our ancestors had won with sword and spear and blood and slaughter. We slept after a while, or at least I slept. I think my father paced the ramparts, but by dawn he was back in the hall, and it was then I was woken by the horn at the high gate, and I stumbled off the platform and out into the morning's first light. There was dew on the grass, a sea eagle circling overhead, and my father's hound streaming from the hall door in answer to the horn's call. I saw my father running down to the low gate, and I followed him until I could wriggle my way through the men who were crowding onto the earthen rampart to stare along the causeway. Horsemen were coming from the south. There were a dozen of them, their horses' hooves sparkling with the dew. My brother's horse was in the lead. It was a brindled stallion, wild-eyed and with a curious gait. It threw its forelegs out as it cantered, and no one could mistake that horse. But it was not Uhtred who rode it. The man bestride the saddle had long, long hair the colour of pale gold, hair that tossed like the horse's tails as he rode. He wore mail, had a flapping scabbard at his side, and an axe slung across one shoulder, and I was certain he was the same man who had danced the ore shafts the previous day. His companions were in leather or wool, and as they neared the fortress, the long-haired man signalled that they should curb their horses as he rode ahead alone. He came within bowshot, though none of us on the rampart put an arrow on the string. Then he pulled the horse to a stop and looked up at the gate. He stared all along the line of men, a mocking expression on his face. Then he bowed, threw something on the path, and wheeled the horse away. He kicked his heels and the horse sped back, and his ragged men joined him to gallop south. What he had thrown onto the path was my brother's severed head. It was brought to my father, who stared at it a long time, but betrayed no feelings. He did not cry, he did not grimace, he did not scowl. He just looked at his eldest son's head, and then he looked at me.
"From this day on," he said, "your name is Uhtred."
Which is how I was named. Father Beorka insisted that I should be baptized again, or else heaven would not know who I was when I arrived with the name Uhtred. I protested, but Gutha wanted it, and my father cared more for her contentment than for mine. And so a barrel was carried into the church and half filled with seawater, and Father Beorka stood me in the barrel and ladled water over my hair. "Receive your servant Uhtred," he intoned, "into the holy company of the saints and into the ranks of the most bright angels." I hope the saints and angels are warmer than I was that day. And after the baptism was done, Gutha wept for me, though why I did not know. She might have done better to weep for my brother. We found out what had happened to him. The three Danish ships had put into the mouth of the River Alm, where there was a small settlement of fishermen and their families. Those folk had prudently fled inland, though a handful stayed and watched the river mouth from woods on higher ground. And they said my brother had come at nightfall and seen the Vikings torching the houses. They were called Vikings when they were raiders, but Danes or pagans when they were traders. And these men had been burning and plundering, so were reckoned to be Vikings. There had seemed very few of them in the settlement. Most were on their ships, and my brother decided to ride down to the cottages and kill those few. But of course it was a trap. The Danes had seen his horsemen coming, and had hidden a ship's crew north of the village, and those 40 men closed behind my brother's party and killed them all. My father claimed his eldest son's death must have been quick, which was a consolation to him. But of course it was not a quick death, for he lived long enough for the Danes to discover who he was, or else why would they have brought his head back to Bebbanburg? The fishermen said they tried to warn my brother, but I doubt they did. Men say such things so that they are not blamed for disaster. But whether my brother was warned or not, he still died, and the Danes took 13 fine swords, 13 good horses, a coat of mail, a helmet, and my old name. But that was not the end of it. A fleeting visit by three ships was no great event, but a week after my brother's death, we heard that a great Danish fleet had rowed up the rivers to capture Eofric. They had won that victory on All Saints' Day, which made Gutha weep, for it suggested God had abandoned us. But there was also good news, for it seemed that my old namesake, King Osbert, had made an alliance with his rival, the would-be King Aelah, and they had agreed to put aside their rivalry, join forces, and take Eofric back. That sounds simple, but of course it took time. Messengers rode, advisers confused, priests prayed, and it was not till Christmas that Osbert and Aelah sealed their peace with oaths. And then they summoned my father's men. But of course we could not march in winter. The Danes were in Eofric, and we left them there until the early spring, when news came that the Northumbrian army would gather outside the city, and to my joy, my father decreed that I would ride south with him. "He's too young," Gutha protested.
"He is almost 11," my father said, "and he must learn to fight."
"He would be better served by continuing his lessons," she said.
"A dead reader is no use to Bebbanburg," my father said, "and Uhtred is now the heir, so he must learn to fight."
That night, he made Beorka show me the parchments kept in the church, the parchments that said we owned the land. Beorka had been teaching me to read for 2 years, but I was a bad pupil, and to Beorka's despair, I could make neither head nor tail of the writings. Beorka sighed, then told me what was in them. "They describe the land," he said, "the land your father owns, and they say the land is his by God's law and by our own law." And one day, it seemed, the lands would be mine. For that night my father dictated a new will, in which he said that if he died, then Bebbanburg would belong to his son, Uhtred, and I would be elderman. And all the folk between the rivers Tweed and the Tyne would swear allegiance to me.
We were kings here once, he told me, and our land was called Bernicia.
He pressed his seal into the red wax, leaving the impression of a wolf's head.
We should be kings again, Helfrich, my uncle, said.
It doesn't matter what they call us, my father said curtly, so long as they obey us.
And then he made Aelfric swear on the comb of St. Cuthbert that he would respect the new will and acknowledge me as Uhtred of Bebbanburg. Aelfric did so swear.
But it won't happen, my father said. We shall slaughter these Danes like sheep in a fold, and we shall ride back here with plunder and honour.
Pray God, Aelfric said.
Aelfric and 30 men would stay at Bebbanburg to guard the fortress and protect the women. He gave me gifts that night, a leather coat that would protect against a sword cut, and, best of all, a helmet around which Ealdwulf the smith had fashioned a band of gilt bronze.
So they will know you are a prince, Aelfric said. He's not a prince, my father said, but an elderman's heir.
Yet he was pleased with his brother's gifts to me, and added two of his own, a short sword and a horse. The sword was an old blade, cut down with a leather scabbard lined with fleece. It had a chunky hilt, was clumsy, yet that night I slept with the blade under my blanket. And next morning, as my stepmother wept on the ramparts of the Highgate, and under a blue, clean sky we rode to war, 250 men went south, following our banner of the Wolf's Head. That was in the year 867, and it was the first time I ever went to war. And I have never ceased.
You will not fight in the shield wall, my father said.
No, father.
Only men can stand in the shield wall, he said. But you will watch, you will learn, and you will discover that the most dangerous stroke is not the sword or axe that you can see, but the one you cannot see, the blade that comes beneath the shields to bite your ankles.
He grudgingly gave me much other advice as we followed the long road south. Of the 250 men who went to Jofarik from Bebbanburg, 120 were on horseback. Those were my father's household men, or else the wealthier farmers, the ones who could afford some kind of armour and had shields and swords. Most of the men were not wealthy, but they were sworn to my father's cause, and they marched with sickles, spears, reaping hooks, fish gaffs and axes. Some carried hunting bows, and all had been ordered to bring a week's food, which was mostly hard bread, harder cheese and smoked fish. Many were accompanied by women. My father had ordered that no women were to march south, but he did not send them back, reckoning that the women would follow anyway, and that men fought better when their wives or lovers were watching, and he was confident that those women would see the levy of Northumbria give the Danes a terrible slaughter. He claimed we were the hardest men of England, much harder than the soft Mercians. Your mother was a Mercian, he added, but said nothing more. He never talked of her. I knew they'd been married less than a year, that she had died giving birth to me, and that she was an elderman's daughter. But as far as my father was concerned, she might never have existed. He claimed to despise the Mercians, but not as much as he scorned the coddled West Saxons.
They don't know hardship in Wessex, he maintained.
But he reserved his severest judgment for the East Anglians. They live in marshes, he once told me, and live like frogs. We Northumbrians had always hated the East Anglians, for long ago they had defeated us in battle, killing Ethelfrith, our king, and husband to the Bebber, after whom our fortress was named. I was to discover later that the East Anglians had given horses and winter shelter to the Danes, who had captured Jofarwick. So my father was right to despise them. They were treacherous frogs. Father Beocker rode south with us. My father did not much like the priest, but did not want to go to war without a man of God to say prayers. Beocker, in turn, was devoted to my father, who had freed him from slavery and provided him with his education. My father could have worshipped the devil, and Beocker, I think, would have turned a blind eye. He was young, clean-shaven and extraordinarily ugly, with a fearful squint, a flattened nose, unruly red hair, and a palsied left hand. He was also very clever, though I did not appreciate it then, resenting that he gave me lessons. The poor man had tried so hard to teach me letters, but I mocked his efforts, preferring to get a beating from my father to concentrating on the alphabet. We followed the Roman road, crossing their great wall at the Tyne, and still going south. The Romans, my father said, had been giants who built wondrous things, but they had gone back to Rome, and the giants had died, and now the only Romans left were priests. But the giants' roads were still there, and as we went south, more men joined us,
until a horde marched on the moors either side of the stony road's broken surface.
The men slept in the open, though my father and his chief retainers would bed for the night in abbeys or barns. We also straggled. Even at 10 years old, I noticed how we straggled. Men had brought liquor with them, or else they stole mead or ale from the villages we passed, and they frequently got drunk and simply collapsed at the roadside and no one seemed to care. "They'll catch up," my father said carelessly. "It's not good," Father Bayoka told me. "What's not good?"
"There should be more discipline.
I have read the Roman Wars and know there must be discipline."
"They'll catch up," I said, echoing my father. That night, we were joined by men from the place called Cetret, where long ago we had defeated the Welsh in a great battle. The newcomers sang of the battle, chanting how we had fed the ravens with the foreigners' blood, and the words cheered my father, who told me we were near Jofrik, and that next day we might expect to join Osbert and Ayla, and how the day after that we would feed the ravens again. We were sitting by a fire, one of hundreds of fires that stretched across the fields. South of us, far off across a flat land, I could see the sky glowing from the light of still more fires, and knew they showed where the rest of Northumbria's army gathered. "The raven is Woden's creature, isn't it?" I asked nervously. My father looked at me sourly.
"Who told you that?"
I shrugged, said nothing.
"Eildwulf?"
He guessed, knowing that Bebbanburg's blacksmith, who had stayed at the fortress with Aelfric, was a secret pagan. "I just heard it," I said, hoping I would get away with the evasion without being hit. "And I know we're descended from Woden."
"We are," my father acknowledged. "But we have a new god now."
He stared balefully across the encampment, where men were drinking.
"Do you know who wins battles, boy?"
"We do, father."
"The side that is least drunk," he said,
and then after a pause,
"But it helps to be drunk."
"Why?"
"Because a shield wall is an awful place."
He gazed into the fire.
"I have been in 6 shield walls," he went on, "and prayed every time it would be the last. Your brother now, he was a man who might have loved the shield wall. He had courage."
He fell silent, thinking, then scowled.
"The man who brought his head. I want his head. I want to spit into his dead eyes, then put his skull on a pole above the low gate."
"You will have it," I said. He sneered at that.
"What do you know?" he asked. "I brought you, boy, because you must see battle, because our men must see that you are here. But you will not fight. You're like a young dog who watches the old dogs kill the boar but doesn't bite. Watch and learn, and maybe one day you'll be useful. But for now, you're nothing but a pup."
He dismissed me with a wave. Next day, the Roman road ran across a flat land, crossing dikes and ditches, until at last we came to where the combined armies of Osbert and Ayla had made their shelters. Beyond them, and just visible through the scattered trees, was Jofrik, and that was where the Danes were. Jofrik was, and still is, the chief city of northern England. It possesses a great abbey, an archbishop, a fortress, high walls, and a vast market. It stands beside the River Ouse, and boasts a bridge, but ships can reach Jofrik from the distant sea, and that was how the Danes had come. They must have known that Northumbria was weakened by civil war, that Osbert, the rightful king, had marched westward to meet the forces of the pretender Ayla, and in the absence of the king, they had taken the city.
It would not have been difficult for them to have discovered Osbert's absence. The trouble between Osbert and Ayla had been brewing for weeks, and Jofurik was filled with traders, many from across the sea, who would have known of the two men's bitter rivalry. One thing I learned about the Danes was that they knew how to spy. The monks who write the chronicles tell us that they came from nowhere, their dragon-proud ships suddenly appearing from a blue vacancy. But it was rarely like that. The Viking crews might attack unexpectedly, but the big fleets, the war fleets, went where they knew there was already trouble. They found an existing wound and filled it like maggots. My father took me close to the city. He and a score of his men, all of us mounted and all wearing mail or leather. We could see the enemy on the walls. Some of the wall was built of stone. That was the Roman work. But much of the city was protected by an earth wall, topped by a high wooden palisade. And to the east of the city, part of that palisade was missing. It seemed to have been burned, for we could see charred wood on top of the earthen wall, where fresh stakes had been driven to hold the new palisade that would replace the burned fence. Beyond the new stakes was a jumble of thatched roofs, the wooden bell towers of three churches, and, on the river, the masts of the Danish fleet. Our scouts claimed there were 34 ships, which was said to mean the Danes had an army of around 1,000 men. Our own army was larger, nearer to 1,500, though it was difficult to count. No one seemed to be in charge. The two leaders, Osbert and Ayla, camped apart, and though they had officially made peace, they refused to speak to each other, communicating instead through messengers. My father, the third most important man in the army, could talk to both, but he was not able to persuade Osbert and Ayla to meet, let alone agree on a plan of campaign. Osbert wished to besiege the city and starve the Danes out, while Ayla urged an immediate attack. The rampart was broken, he said, and an assault would drive deep into the tangle of streets where the Danes could be hunted down and killed. I do not know which course my father preferred, for he never said, but in the end, the decision was taken away from us. Our army could not wait. We had brought some food, but that was soon exhausted, and the men were going ever farther afield to find more, and some of those men did not return. They just slipped home. Other men grumbled that their farms needed work, and if they did not return home, they would face a hungry year. A meeting was called of every important man, and they spent all day arguing. Osbert attended the meeting, which meant Ayla did not, though one of his chief supporters was there and hinted that Osbert's reluctance to assault the city was caused by cowardice. Perhaps it was, for Osbert did not respond to the jibe, proposing instead that we dig our own forts outside the city. Three or four such forts, he said, would trap the Danes. Our best fighters could man the forts, and our other men could go home to look after their fields. Another man proposed building a new bridge across the river, a bridge that would trap the Danish fleet, and he argued the point tediously, though I think everyone knew that we did not have the time to make a bridge across such a wide river. Besides, King Osbert said, we want the Danes to take their ships away, let them go back to the sea, let them go and trouble someone else. A bishop pleaded for more time, saying that Ealdorman Egbert, who held land south of Jofurik, had yet to arrive with his men. Nor is Rishig here, a priest said, speaking of another great lord. He's sick, Osbert said. Sickness of courage, Ayla's spokesman sneered. Give them time, the bishop suggested. With Egbert's and Rishig's men, we shall have enough troops to frighten the Danes with sheer numbers. My father said nothing at the meeting, though it was plain many men wanted him to speak, and I was perplexed that he stayed silent. But that night, Beok explained why. If he said we should attack, the priest said, then men would assume he had sided with Ayla, while if he encouraged a siege, he would be seen to be on Osbert's side. Does it matter? Beoka looked at me across the campfire, or one of his eyes looked at me, while the other wandered somewhere in the night. When the Danes are beaten, he said, then Osbert and Ayla's feud will start again. Your father wants none of it. But whichever side he supports, I said, will win. But suppose they kill each other? Beoka asked. Who will be king then? I looked at him, understood, said nothing. And who will be king thereafter?
Beok asked, and he pointed at me. You. And a king should be able to read and write. A king, I answered scornfully, can always hire men who can read and write. Then, next morning, the decision to attack or besiege was made for us, because news came that more Danish ships had appeared at the mouth of the River Humber, and that could only mean the enemy would be reinforced within a few days. And so my father, who had stayed silent for so long, finally spoke.
We must attack, he told both Osbert and Ayla, before the new boats come.
Ayla, of course, agreed enthusiastically, and even Osbert understood that the new ships meant that everything was changed. Besides, the Danes inside the city had been having problems with their new wall. We woke one morning to see a whole new stretch of palisade, the wood raw and bright. But a great wind blew that day, and the new work collapsed, and that caused much merriment in our encampments. The Danes, men said, could not even build a wall.
But they can build ships, Father Beok had told me.
So?
A man who can build a ship, the young priest said, can usually build a wall. It is not so hard as shipbuilding.
It fell down.
Perhaps it was meant to fall down, Beok said. And when I just stared at him, he explained, perhaps they want us to attack there.
I do not know if he told my father of his suspicions, but if he did, then I have no doubt my father dismissed them. He did not trust Beoka's opinions on war. The priest's usefulness was in encouraging God to smite the Danes, and that was all. And to be fair, Beoka did pray mightily and long that God would give us the victory. And the day after the wall collapsed, we gave God his chance to fulfill Beoka's prayers. We attacked. I do not know if every man who assaulted Jofrik was drunk, but they would have been had there been enough mead, ale, and birch wine to go around. The drinking had gone on much of the night, and I woke to find men vomiting in the dawn. Those few who, like my father, possessed mail shirts pulled them on. Most were armoured in leather, while some men had no protection other than their coats. Weapons were sharpened on whetstones. The priests walked around the camp scattering blessings, while men swore oaths of brotherhood and loyalty. Some banded together and promised to share their plunder equally. A few looked pale, and more than a handful sneaked away through the dikes that crossed the flat, damp landscape. A score of men were ordered to stay at the camp and guard the women and horses, though Father Beoka and I were both ordered to mount.
You'll stay on horseback, my father told me. And you'll stay with him, he added to the priest.
Of course, my lord, Beoka said.
If anything happens, my father was deliberately vague, then ride to Bebbanburg, shut the gate and wait there.
God is on our side, Beoka said.
My father looked a great warrior, which indeed he was, though he claimed to be getting too old for fighting. His greying beard jutted over his mail coat, above which he had hung a crucifix carved from oxbone that had been a gift from Guther. His sword belt was leather, studded with silver, while his great sword, Bonebreaker, was sheathed in leather banded with gilt bronze strappings. His boots had iron plates on either sides of the ankles, reminding me of his advice about the shield wall, while his helmet was polished so that it shone, and its face piece, with its eye holes and snarling mouth, was inlaid with silver. His round shield was made of limewood, had a heavy iron boss, was covered in leather and painted with the wolf's head. Ealdorman Uhtred was going to war. The horn summoned the army. There was little order in the array. There had been arguments about who should be on the right or left, but Beok had told me the argument had been settled when the bishop cast dice, and King Osbert was now on the right, Ayla on the left, and my father in the centre, and those three chieftains' banners were advanced as the horns called. The men assembled under the banners. My father's household troops, his best warriors, were at the front, and behind them were the bands of the Thanes. Thanes were important men, holders of great lands, some of them with their own fortresses, and they were the men who shared my father's platform in the feasting hall, and men who had to be watched in case their ambitions made them try to take his place. But now they loyally gathered behind him, and the churls, free men of the lowest rank, assembled with them. Men fought in family groups or with friends, There were plenty of boys with the army, though I was the only one on horseback and the only one with a sword and helmet. I could see a scatter of Danes behind the unbroken palisades either side of the gap where their wall had fallen down, but most of their army filled that gap, making a shield barrier on top of the earthen wall, and it was a high earthen wall, at least 10 or 12 feet high, and steep, so it would be a hard climb into the face of the waiting killers, but I was confident we would win. I was 10 years old, almost 11. The Danes were shouting at us, but we were too far away to hear their insults. Their shields, round like ours, were painted yellow, black, brown, and blue. Our men began beating weapons on their shields, and that was a fearsome sound. The first time I ever heard an army making that war music. The clashing of ash spear shafts and iron sword blades on shield wood. "It is a terrible thing," Beorka said to me. "War. It is an awful thing." I said nothing. I thought it was glorious and wonderful. "The shield wall is where men die," Beorka said, and he kissed the wooden cross that hung about his neck. "The gates of heaven and hell will be jostling with souls before this day is done," he went on gloomily. "Aren't the dead carried to a feasting hall?" I asked. He looked at me very strangely, then appeared shocked. "Where did you hear that?" "At Bebbanburg," I said, sensible enough not to admit that it was Eldwulf the Smith who told me those tales as I watched him beating rods of iron into sword blades. "That is what heathens believe," Beorka said sternly. "They believe dead warriors are carried to Woden's corpse hall to feast until the world's ending. But it is a grievously wrong belief. It is an error. But the Danes are always in error. They bow down to idols. They deny the true God. They are wrong." "But a man must die with a sword in his hand," I insisted. "I can see we must teach you a proper catechism when this is done," the priest said sternly. I said nothing more. I was watching, trying to fix every detail of that day in my memory. The sky was summer blue, with just a few clouds off in the west, and the sunlight reflected from our army's spear points like glints of light flickering on the summer sea. Cowslips dotted the meadow where the army assembled, and a cuckoo called from the woods behind us where a crowd of our women were watching the army. There were swans on the river that was placid, for there was little wind. The smoke from the cooking fires inside Jofurik rose almost straight into the air, and that sight reminded me that there would be a feast in the city that night, a feast of roasted pork or whatever else we found in the enemy's stores. Some of our men, those in the foremost ranks, were darting forward to shout at the enemy, or else dare him to come and do private battle between the lines, one man on one man. But none of the Danes broke rank. They just stared, waited, their spears a hedge, their shields a wall. And then our horns blew again, and the shouting and the shield banging faded as our army lurched forward. It went raggedly. Later, much later, I was to understand the reluctance of men to launch themselves against a shield wall, let alone a shield wall held at the top of a steep earthen bank. But on that day, I was just impatient for our army to hurry forward and break the impudent Danes. And Beorka had to restrain me, catching hold of my bridle to stop me riding into the rearmost ranks. "We shall wait until they break through," he said. "I want to kill a Dane," I protested. "Don't be stupid, Uhtred," Beorka said angrily. "You try and kill a Dane," he went on, "and your father will have no sons. You are his only child now, and it is your duty to live." So I did my duty, and I hung back, and I watched as so slowly our army found its courage and advanced towards the city. The river was on our left, the empty encampment behind our right, and the inviting gap in the city wall was to our front. There the Danes were waiting silently, their shields overlapping. "The bravest will go first," Beorka said to me. And your father will be one of them. They will make a wedge, what the Latin authors call a porcinum caput. You know what that means? No, nor did I care. A swine's head, like the tusk of a boar. The bravest will go first, and if they break through, the others will follow. Beoka was right. Three wedges formed in front of our lines, one each from the household troops of Osbert, Ayla, and my father. The men stood close together, their shields overlapping like the Danish shields, while the rearward ranks of each wedge held their shields high like a roof. And then, when they were ready, the men in the three wedges gave a great cheer and started forward. They did not run. I had expected them to run, but men cannot keep the wedge tight if they run. The wedge is war in slow time, slow enough for the men inside the wedge to wonder how strong the enemy is, and to fear that the rest of the army will not follow. But they did. The three wedges had not gone more than 20 paces before the remaining mass of men moved forward. "I want to be closer," I said. "You will wait," Beoka said. I could hear the shouts now, shouts of defiance and shouts to give a man courage. And then the archers on the city walls loosed their bows, and I saw the glitter of the feathers as the arrows slashed down toward the wedges. And a moment later the throwing spears came, arching over the Danish line to fall on the upheld shields. Amazingly, at least to me, it seemed that none of our men was struck, though I could see their shields were stuck with arrows and spears like hedgehog spines, and still the three wedges advanced. And now our own bowmen were shooting at the Danes, and a handful of our men broke from the ranks behind the wedges to hurl their own spears at the enemy shield wall. "Not long now," Beoka said nervously. He made the sign of the cross. He was praying silently, and his crippled left hand was twitching. I was watching my father's wedge, the central wedge, the one just in front of the Wolf's Head banner, and I saw the closely touching shields vanish into the ditch that lay in front of the earthen wall, and I knew my father was perilously close to death. And I urged him to win, to kill, to give the name Uhtred of Bebbanburg even more renown. And then I saw the shield wedge emerge from the ditch and, like a monstrous beast, crawl up the face of the wall. "The advantage they have," Beoka said in the patient voice he used for teaching, "is that the enemy's feet are easy targets when you come from below." I think he was trying to reassure himself, but I believed him anyway. And it must have been true, for my father's formation, first up the wall, did not seem to be checked when they met the enemy's shield wall. I could see nothing now, except the flash of blades rising and falling. And I could hear that sound. The real music of battle. The chop of iron on wood. Iron on iron. Yet the wedge was still moving. Like a boar's razor-sharp tusk, it had pierced the Danish shield wall and was moving forward. And though the Danes wrapped around the wedge, it seemed our men were winning, for they pressed forward across the earthen bank, and the soldiers behind must have sensed that Elderman Uhtred had brought them victory, for they suddenly cheered and surged to help the beleaguered wedge. "God be praised," Beoka said, "for the Danes were fleeing. One moment they had formed a thick shield wall bristling with weapons, and now they were vanishing into the city, and our army, with the relief of men whose lives have been spared, charged after them." "Slowly now," Beoka said, walking his horse forward and leading mine by the bridle. The Danes had gone. Instead, the earthen wall was black with our men, who were scrambling through the gap in the city's ramparts. Then down the bank's farther side into the streets and alleyways beyond. The three flags, my father's wolf head, Ayla's war axe, and Osbert's cross, were inside Jofrik. I could hear men cheering, and I kicked my horse, forcing her out of Beoka's grasp. "Come back!" he shouted. But though he followed me, he did not try to drag me away. We had won. God had given us victory, and I wanted to be close enough to smell the slaughter. Neither of us could get into the city, because the gap in the palisade was choked with our men. But I kicked the horse again, and she forced her way into the press. Some men protested at what I was doing, Then they saw the gilt bronze circle on my helmet and knew I was nobly born, and so they tried to help me through, while Beoka, stranded at the back of the crowd, shouted that I should not get too far ahead of him. "Catch up," I called back to him. Then he shouted again, but this time his voice was frantic, terrified, and I turned to see Danes streaming across the field where our army had advanced. It was a horde of Danes who must have sallied from the city's northern gate to cut off our retreat. And they must have known we would retreat, because it seemed they could build walls after all, and had built them across the streets inside the city, then feigned flight from the ramparts to draw us into their killing ground, and now they sprang the trap. Some of the Danes who came from the city were mounted. Most were on foot, and Beoka panicked. I do not blame him. The Danes like killing Christian priests, and Beoka must have seen death, did not desire martyrdom, and so he turned his horse and kicked it hard, and it galloped away beside the river, and the Danes, not caring about the fate of one man where so many were trapped, let him go. It is a truth that in most armies the timid men and those with the feeblest weapons are at the back. The brave go to the front, the weak seek the rear. So if you can get to the back of an enemy army, you will have a massacre. I'm an old man now, and it has been my fate to see panic flicker through many armies. That panic is worse than the terror of sheep penned in a cleft and being assaulted by wolves, more frantic than the writhing of salmon caught in a net and dragged to the air. The sound of it must tear the heavens apart. But to the Danes that day it was the sweet sound of victory, and to us it was death. I tried to escape. God knows I panicked too. I had seen Beoka racing away beside the riverside willows, and I managed to turn the mare. But then one of our own men snatched at me, presumably wanting my horse, and I had the wit to draw my short sword and hack blindly at him as I kicked back my heels. But all I achieved was to ride out of the panicked mass into the path of the Danes. And all around me men were screaming and the Danish axes and swords were chopping and swinging. The grim work, the blood feast, the song of the blade, they call it. And perhaps I was saved for a moment because I was the only one in our army who was on horseback, and a score of the Danes were also mounted, and perhaps they mistook me for one of their own. But then one of those Danes called to me in a language I did not speak, and I looked at him and saw his long hair, unhelmeted, his long, fair hair, and his silver-coloured mail, and the wide grin on his wild face, and I recognised him as a man who had killed my brother, and like the fool I was, I screamed at him. A standard-bearer was just behind the long-haired Dane, flaunting an eagle's wing on a long pole. Tears were blurring my sight, and perhaps the battle madness came onto me because, despite my panic, I rode at the long-haired Dane and struck at him with my small sword, and his sword parried mine, and my feeble blade bent like a herring's spine. It just bent, and he drew back his own sword for the killing stroke, saw my pathetic bent blade, and began to laugh. I was pissing myself. He was laughing, and I beat at him again with the useless sword, and still he laughed. And then he leaned over, plucked the weapon from my hand and threw it away. He picked me up then. I was screaming and hitting at him, but he thought it all so very funny, and he draped me belly down on the saddle in front of him, and then he spurred into the chaos to continue the killing. And that was how I met Ragnar. Ragnar the Fearless, my brother's killer, and the man whose head was supposed to grace a pole on Bebbanburg's ramparts, Earl Ragnar. Chapter 1. Part 1. A Pagan Childhood. The Danes were clever that day. They'd made new walls inside the city, invited our men into the streets, trapped them between the new walls, surrounded them and killed them. They did not kill all the Northumbrian army, for even the fiercest warriors tire of slaughter, and besides, the Danes made much money from slavery.
Most of the slaves taken in England were sold to farmers in the wild Northern Isles, or to Ireland, or sent back across the sea to the Danish lands. But some, I learned, were taken to the big slave markets in Francia, and a few were shipped south to a place where there was no winter, and where men with faces the colour of scorched wood would pay good money for men, and even better money for young women. But they killed enough of us. They killed Ayla, and they killed Osbert, and they killed my father. Ayla and my father were fortunate, for they died in battle, swords in their hands. But Osbert was captured, and he was tortured that night as the Danes feasted in a city stinking of blood. Some of the victors guarded the walls, others celebrated in the captured houses, but most gathered in the hall of Northumbria's defeated king, where Ragnar took me. I did not know why he took me there. I half expected to be killed, or at best sold into slavery. But Ragnar made me sit with his men and put a roasted goose leg, half a loaf of bread and a pot of ale in front of me, then cuffed me cheerfully round the head. The other Danes ignored me at first. They were too busy getting drunk and cheering the fights that broke out once they were drunk. But the loudest cheers came when the captured Osbert was forced to fight against a young warrior who had extraordinary skill with a sword. He danced around the king, then chopped off his left hand before slitting his belly with a sweeping cut. And because Osbert was a heavy man, his guts spilled out like eels, slithering from a ruptured sack. Some of the Danes were weak with laughter after that. The king took a long time to die, and while he cried for relief, the Danes crucified a captured priest who had fought against them in the battle. They were intrigued and repelled by our religion, and they were angry when the priest's hands pulled free of the nails, and some claimed it was impossible to kill a man that way, and they argued that point drunkenly, then tried to nail the priest to the hall's timber walls a second time, until bored with it, one of their warriors slammed a spear into the priest's chest, crushing his ribs and mangling his heart. A handful of them turned on me once the priest was dead, and because I had worn a helmet with a gilt bronze circlet, they thought I must be a king's son, and they put me in a robe, and a man climbed onto the table to piss on me. And just then a huge voice bellowed at them to stop, and Ragnar bullied his way through the crowd. He snatched the robe from me and harangued the men, telling them I knew not what. But whatever he said made them stop, and Ragnar then put an arm around my shoulders and took me to a dais at the side of the hall and gestured I should climb up to it. An old man was eating alone there. He was blind, both eyes milky white, and had a deep-lined face framed by grey hair as long as Ragnar's. He heard me clamber up and asked a question, and Ragnar answered and then walked away.
"You must be hungry, boy,"
the old man said in English. I did not answer. I was terrified of his blind eyes.
"Have you vanished?"
he asked.
"Did the dwarves pluck you down to the underearth?"
"I'm hungry," I admitted.
"So you are there after all,"
he said. "And there's pork here, and bread and cheese and ale. Tell me your name." I almost said Osbert, then remembered I was Ortrud. "Ortrud," I said.
"An ugly name," the old man said. "But my son said I was to look after you, so I will. But you must look after me too. You could cut me some pork."
"Your son?" I asked.
"Earl Ragnar," he said, "sometimes called Ragnar the Fearless. Who were they killing in here?"
"The king," I said, "and a priest."
"Which king?"
"Osbert."
"Did he die well?"
"No."
"Then he shouldn't have been king."
"Are you a king?" I asked.
He laughed. "I am Raven," he said. "And once I was an earl and a warrior. But now I am blind, so I am no use to anyone. They should beat me over the head with a cudgel and send me on my way to the netherworld."
I said nothing to that, because I did not know what to say.
"But I try to be useful," Raven went on, his hands groping for bread. "I speak your language,
and the language of the Britons, and the tongue of the Vends, and the speech of the Frisians, and that of the Franks. Language is now my trade, boy, because I have become a skald. A skald? A skop, you would call me. A poet, a weaver of dreams, a man who makes glory from nothing and dazzles you with its making. And my job now is to tell this day's tale in such a way that men will never forget our great deeds. But if you cannot see, I asked, how can you tell what happened? Ravan laughed at that. Have you heard of Odin? Then you should know that Odin sacrificed one of his own eyes so that he could obtain the gift of poetry. So perhaps I am twice as good a skald as Odin, eh? I am descended from Woden, I said. Are you? He seemed impressed, or perhaps he just wanted to be kind. So who are you, Uhtred, descendant of the great Odin? I am the elder man of Bebbanburg, I said, and that reminded me I was fatherless, and my defiance crumpled, and to my shame I began to cry. Ravan ignored me as he listened to the drunken shouts and the songs and the shrieks of the girls who'd been captured in our camp and who now provided the warriors with the reward for their victory. And watching their antics took my mind off my sorrow, because in truth I'd never seen such things before, though God be thanked I took plenty of such rewards myself in times to come. Bebbanburg, Ravan said. I was there before you were born. It was 20 years ago. At Bebbanburg? Not in the fortress, he admitted. It was far too strong. But I was to the north of it, on the island where the monks pray. I killed 6 men there. Not monks, men. Warriors. He smiled to himself, remembering. Now tell me, Elderman Uhtred of Bebbanburg, he went on. What is happening? So I became his eyes, and I told him of the men dancing, and the men stripping the women of their clothes, and what they then did to the women. But Ravan had no interest in that. What, he wanted to know, are Ivar and Ubba doing? Ivar and Ubba? They will be on the high platform. Ubba is the shorter, and looks like a barrel with a beard, and Ivar is so skinny that he is called Ivar the Boneless. He is so thin that you could press his feet together and shoot him from a bowstring.
End of Disc 1.